Chapter 6. Lurid Carnival of Global Commerce. With so much of my time being spent in factories, I eventually took an assistant, someone who could answer the phone, water the plants, and pay the bills while I was away. Tina was from Hunan, and while she had missed the chance to attend university, she more than made up for it through self-study. Many of those in South China who claimed to have a degree in English could not actually speak the language. Without much schooling or any foreign contacts, Tina had been able to teach herself to read English and to speak it with surprising fluency. She was naturally curious about the wider world, and on the subject of China, she held many frank and interesting views. It soon became our habit to go out for lunch when I was in town, and it was during some of those times that I was on the receiving end of many surprising insights. Southern Chinese felt a natural affinity for humid environments, and while the rain kept people indoors in most places, in Guangzhou, it sent them into the streets. As we walked down the sidewalk, sharing my oversized umbrella and talking about where to go, the spine of one oncoming umbrella slashed my cheek. I muttered in pain, and Tina saw me touch my face. "You should ask that person for compensation," she said, even before considering my physical pain. She was referring to the man, or woman, who was already long gone. "I'm all right," I said, touching the spot that stung. "But if someone causes harm, they should compensate you." She was making a point about a principle. Tina was a country girl, someone who had not been in the city for very long, and while we both called Guangzhou home, she saw in me something of a kindred spirit, a fellow outsider. "So, how much is a scratched face worth?" I asked, out of curiosity. 300 or 400 renminbi, she said, without the least bit of hesitation. She knew the going rate. It was somewhere around $50. Average factory workers earned about $100 a month, and office workers were making close to $300 per month. It was a significant sum. Surely they wouldn't pay. The person would just run away. "You can hold them," Tina said. "Don't allow them to go." She demonstrated how this was done by grabbing at her purse strap. I could not see myself ever doing this, but I understood how such a system might work. The guilty party would be motivated to settle on the spot because getting the police involved introduced the chance of an unpredictable, possibly undesirable, outcome. Detaining someone physically in order to force a settlement would never work in a place like the United States, I told Tina. It would result in an immediate brawl. Ironically enough, it was precisely because the Chinese were nonviolent that such rough handling could be used as a means of dispute resolution, and it also mattered that folks knew how to calculate and negotiate damages on the fly. At lunch, I mentioned that I had seen two motorists settle the matter of a car accident by the side of the road. They did not involve the police, and they resolved their own dispute rather peaceably. Arriving at a settlement had involved taking into account allocations of responsibility, bearing in mind relative income levels, and taking a guess at the amount of property damage that had been caused. I told Tina that it had been fascinating to watch and that I had been genuinely impressed with how neither of them felt the need to involve any third party. Chinese perhaps had no choice but to work out disputes for themselves, I suggested, because they lacked access to formal remedies. Tina said that I had it backwards, that they didn't bother with intermediaries such as insurance agents or attorneys because they felt more than capable of handling their own affairs. In Guangzhou, I lived in what might have been considered a ghetto for foreigners, though the foreign community made up a minority of the total population. Tianhe, as the neighborhood was called, was near the East train station, where the line that whisked passengers to Hong Kong originated, and it was home to a growing number of high-rise buildings and commercial development projects. "We are becoming more like Shanghai," one of my neighbors said to me one day, while pointing out the number of foreigners in the area was growing. She meant well by the comment, and the association with Shanghai was an apparent reference to the number of foreigners there. The presence of Westerners was seen as a sign of modernization in Guangzhou. My neighbors were in the habit of mentioning the influx of foreigners in any conversation connected to rising real estate prices, and related to some of these attitudes, I found myself on the receiving end of many small kindnesses. Doors were often held open for me, and it was not unusual for some neighbor to insist that I take the next taxi, even though he had been waiting for some time himself. Some chalked up such behavior to Chinese hospitality, the art of keqi, but at the same time, there was something about the expatriate experience that was nearly colonial. When China had been poor, these customs made sense, and it was interesting to ponder how long certain attitudes would persist. I lived on a street called Longkou, literally, the mouth of the dragon, As if the name were not auspicious enough, Chinese dragons, unlike their Western counterparts, are benevolent and lucky. The housing complex was named Eaton 18, and its logo showed a golf ball with two clubs crossing it at the center. The complex was not associated with any famous British boarding school, nor was it near any golf course. The number 18 was thrown in for good measure, presumably because it sounded favorable to Chinese. The numbers Yao Fa, taken together, were a homonym for going to get rich. More than for any lucky association, though, I lived there for the amenities. The towers of the complex were over 30 stories. There was a swimming pool. We had a pond with goldfish that swam next to a quaint wooden bridge. It was easily one of the nicest apartment blocks in the city, and the most notable thing about the place was that a significant number of residents were employees of China's largest media organization, Xinhua News Agency. This was a news service owned and operated by the government. The journalists in my building owned their apartments, which had been given to them by their employer. The property had come to the government through a backdoor connection. The developers needed government approval to build the complex, and so they earmarked a certain number of units for the government. Government employees, as well as the police and the military, were accustomed to getting special access to key properties. It was a perk offered in lieu of a cash payment, and while the journalists who received these apartments were supposed to live in them, many took the rent and occupied a cheaper place somewhere else. My own landlord worked for Xinhua as a journalist and lived just across the street in an apartment that rented for less than half of what I was paying him. Such arrangements might be considered unethical business practices in other countries, but not in China, where mutual back-scratching was an accepted norm. In the United States, of course, journalists almost took a vow of poverty to pursue their careers, and their reward, perhaps, was the knowledge that they provided a meaningful check on government activities. That was one of the advantages of a free press, anyway. In China, if you said the right things and kept your government's secrets, the rewards were quite sweet, and you could have a nice standard of living if you wanted it. I heard shouting outside my apartment one evening. At first, I thought that an international sporting event was on television and that China had scored a meaningful goal. When the racket persisted, I looked outside and saw that a small group had gathered down on the street for something else. They were protesters who had come from another neighborhood, and they were standing in front of a building that housed a local government office. The crowd was made up of adult men and women, and some had come as couples. They were upset about a road that was going to be built near their homes. I watched for a while as they chanted slogans. They were not particularly organized, and someone in the crowd told me that they had only heard about the new road project earlier that day. Protesters in China were typically doubly upset. They were angry over whatever issue they were up in arms about, but then they were also frustrated by the futility of their actions. By the time these protesters had learned about the road being built near their homes, it was already too late. The project was in motion, and there was no stopping it. In a democratic country, citizens have options for channeling political energies. They can establish organizations around a common purpose, recruit members, and gather and disseminate meaningful data that might enable everyone to arrive at rational conclusions. They can discuss, debate, raise awareness, lobby politicians, bake cookies, vote, whatever. "What happens next?" I asked one woman who stood watching. "Nothing," she said. "Nothing." I expected that at some point, someone was going to come out of the building and tell everyone to break it up and go home. The woman explained that the government office was actually closed. Of course it was. It was already late. These angry protesters had all been shouting at an empty building, and what was worse was that they all knew it. China was documenting over 30,000 separate protests annually. All but a handful went unreported by the media. The rallies were almost invariably of a local nature, and most died right where they started. One reason for self-restraint was that protesters could not be sure what kind of attention their activities might attract. On the one hand, a fuss might bring government officers from a higher level down to help address a situation. On the other hand, it might result in local officials making things worse for the protesters in some way. In the city's central business district, I knew of another kind of protest that was taking place. The government had announced that a power station was to be built adjacent to a residential complex. Those who had purchased their apartments thought it unfair that they had been told only after investing their money. Many homeowners in the complex hung vertical red banners from their balconies in protest. The message implied on the long signs was that certain local officials had been derelict in their duty. It was summertime in Guangzhou, and temperatures were soaring. Some officials who had apparently felt pressure waited until it got particularly hot, and when Friday came, they cut the power to the entire complex. For the whole weekend, residents who would have otherwise been enjoying themselves in their comfortable, air-conditioned high-rise apartments were left at home to suffer in the heat. Such a message was clear. Got a complaint? Sit in your sweltering apartments and meditate on it. Almost as if on cue, the group that had gathered near my building stopped their shouting. Having accomplished nothing, the crowd slowly dispersed. A few stomped off, most just shuffled away. These were adults, but they seemed more like teenagers who had just suffered a painful reminder of how their rights were limited, if not entirely illusory. Guangzhou was said to be a second-tier city. It was a designation meant to cast the city as a Johnny-come-lately. In reality, though, it had been a center for international commerce long before other, better-known urban centers. China's showcase cities, Shanghai and Beijing, got most of the press, but when China began to emerge from its dark, isolationist period following the Cultural Revolution, the first steps were taken in the south. Separated from the rest of the country by mountain ranges, South China had already for centuries developed commercial opportunities with traders from afar. And as a result of the province's proximity to Hong Kong, whose economy remained robust, the region was poised to take off again. So it was no accident that when Deng Xiaoping announced, "To get rich is glorious," he did so from the southern province of Guangdong, where Guangzhou is located. If releasing so much pent-up entrepreneurial energy was akin to setting the economy on fire, it was near Guangzhou that the match had been struck. In the modern era, Guangzhou was an attractive base for modern traders, if only for the diversity of manufacturers that it provided. Most factories could be reached by car within 90 minutes from the city. Shanghai offered a similar diversity in manufactured goods, but the radius of the manufacturing area was closer to 4 hours. For this reason alone, Guangzhou attracted a greater number of generalists, importers who traded in a little bit of this and a little bit of that. The Canton Fair added to the city's appeal as a base for importers. A fast-paced city in normal times, twice each year Guangzhou hosted one of the largest trade shows in the world. The Canton Fair was an exhibition that lasted weeks and covered every major category of export manufacture. When the fair was in town, the city swelled with visitors from abroad. So many importers from just about every country in the world attended that it was nearly impossible to find a taxi or get a table in a restaurant during fair times. For this reason, many of the foreigners who lived in town hated the fair. They planned trips so as to avoid being in town when it was on, or else they shuttered themselves indoors as if expecting a typhoon. I actually enjoyed the fair, and attended whenever possible. It was an opportunity to get a quick overview of changes in industry, and it was also a chance to see fresh faces. The sudden influx of business travelers charged the city with energy, and these new arrivals brought with them an optimism that was palpable. Most visitors to the show were small and medium-sized importers, just as the companies operating the exhibition booths were not very large. China made products for big brand, Fortune 500 companies, but products for these sorts of corporations were not on display at the Canton Fair. This was a trade show for all of the other products that China manufactured. The trade show was heavily skewed towards smaller players. It was also a great magnet for first-time importers. Instead of flying all around the country to visit dozens of prospective factories, would-be importers found that the fair was a convenient opportunity to meet with many manufacturers at once. For those who were merely curious about what was happening in China, the show provided a quick introduction. Experienced traders had a sense of this and were largely of the opinion that the trade show was for suckers. Manufacturers tended to have the same idea and quoted higher prices at the fair than they did outside of fair times. Importing companies that spent a great deal of time and effort fighting factory price increases resented the newer, smaller players who came into the market and willingly paid higher prices for the same goods. At the front of the exhibition hall was a large red banner framed on either side by a long column of helium balloons. I arrived at the fair in the morning and was stopped by a man and his wife. They wanted to have their picture taken there, and I obliged. They were from Venezuela, they told me after I had taken the photo, and I didn't have to ask whether it was their first visit. Importers who were trying to negotiate for the right price while fighting to assure higher quality standards rarely looked as happy as that couple did. The number of booths at the Canton Fair was growing fast, even as factories were said to be closing. One reason had to do with the increasing number of agents. For many of these go-betweens, the fair posed a small economic hurdle, the modest expense of a small booth space in most cases. Many foreign visitors had no idea these were agents. Their exhibition spaces appeared no different than those of the manufacturers. Some of the largest exhibitors in certain halls belonged to trading companies who aggregated a large number of products in a given category. I stopped by one such booth, a hardware company that carried thousands of separate products. An importer that owned a small hardware store, or perhaps a few such stores, might come and select items as if in a warehouse. The trading company had created a small brand for itself with attractive orange and black lettering so that any retailer could pretend it was representing the products of a well-known company. "Do you make any of these?" I asked the representative of the trading company who turned out to be the company's president. Rather proudly, he said that he did. He manufactured all of the products in his booth. There were products made of plastics and others that were made with metal. Some of the tools were precision-made, but others were obviously produced using a cast iron process. Different processes suggested different suppliers, but the man said that he owned 23 separate factories. It was an amusing claim, if only because I knew factory owners who ran themselves ragged just to keep one plant operating smoothly. Maybe I even knew of one industrialist who managed to operate two factories. The idea that anyone could successfully manage 23 separate facilities was absurd, and here he was, taking a full week out of his busy schedule to sit in a fair to shake hands with strangers. I understood why some made such claims anyway. It was because these trading companies wanted importers to feel as though they were going direct to the manufacturer. Many of the small exhibitors at the Canton Fair, there were thousands of them, focused on products that would ensure they at least recouped their investment for the trade show. There was a heavy emphasis on products with a high impulse buy factor, and everywhere you looked there were people selling poker chip sets, ashtrays, and gumball machines, as well as dozens of companies selling plastic cases for compact discs. Buyers often got so excited on their very first trip that they placed an order even before they determined what they might actually do with whatever it was they were shipping home. The show was like an international bazaar, a lurid carnival of global commerce, and a great deal of on-the-spot haggling went on. Exhibitors would start sometimes with a higher price, expecting that their customers would want to see a quick reduction. Others liked to ask prospective buyers, "What's your market?" Customers who came from France did not get quoted the same prices as those from Russia. This business about "what's your market" incensed many importers, who suspected that they might not be getting the absolute lowest price available. Factory owners were good at sizing up their customers, and they took their cues from the vendors who sold vegetables in China's many wet markets. They tended to charge more for customers who could afford to pay extra. There was no such thing as a single China price for any given product. Pricing was all over the place, and manufacturers got whatever they could. Price discrimination was nothing new in business, but it was a practice associated with marketing companies, not manufacturers. Buyers expected that a factory would make its product available to all at the same price, but this was not how it worked in China. Importers resented that they were sized up in such a crude fashion, and that they might be disadvantaged in a pricing negotiation because of their background. I walked past a corner booth, as a tall man in a checkered shirt was negotiating a price on metal posts. His English was accented, and he spoke very loudly in a brusque tone. I paused, watching, while he and the factory owner put each other through their paces. "How much? How much?" the importer shouted. He sounded as if he were in a great hurry. The factory owner looked down at the importer's shoes before quoting him a price. $1.60. "That is not price," the importer said. The factory owner did not seem bothered by the shouting. "I buy big quantity," the importer promised. His accent was heavy, and he pronounced it quantity. Importers were always talking up their order sizes in the hope of getting a break on volume. Neither buyer nor seller was from an English-speaking country, and yet they both spoke in English. They also both quoted prices in dollars. The supplier lowered his price by a few pennies. "No, big quantity, 40-foot container." The supplier looked weary for a moment and glanced at his price sheets. He took out a calculator and punched in some numbers. He then gave what appeared to be his final price. "For you, $1.39," he said. "That's right," said the importer. "Now, I want to order 200 pieces. 200? Only 200? You said you buy 40-foot container. 200 pieces is nothing. It does not fill even a 20-foot container." "Yes," said the buyer, "but first I need samples, don't I?" Walking through the housewares hall, I happened across an importer who was in an argument with one supplier. Whatever they were discussing was being made more difficult by a language barrier. "You need any help?" I asked the importer, who looked frustrated. From his accent, I took him to be Eastern European. At first he said that he was all right, and then he explained that he was having difficulty convincing his factory not to display his products in their booth. He pointed to a stack of boxes, on top of which was a ceramic dinnerware collection. It was decorated in a light yellow and green pattern. He explained that he was from Poland, and that he sold these items throughout Europe. "The product is yours?" "Yes," he said. "You gave the factory the designs." "Yes, my original designs. I have customers at this show," he said. "If they see my product here, then they know where I am manufacturing." He worried that the factory might sell his product to his customers directly. Even if the factory didn't do that, his customers might learn how much he was paying. For all kinds of reasons, he wanted to keep his supplier hidden. The factory representative insisted that she had done nothing wrong, and that her company had the right to display examples of products that it made. If they could not show off examples of their work, then how could they get any new business? Famous brands were not displayed at the Canton Fair, for fear that trademarks might be violated through counterfeit sales. The products of smaller importers found their way onto the exhibition floor, but the same principles generally applied. Factories tended to respect the wishes of their customers on this point. Suggesting some of this to the supplier, I managed to get the factory rep excited. Seeing her reaction, the importer panicked. "It's all right. I don't want to do anything to make them upset," he said. The man tried then to apologize to his supplier, though he had done nothing wrong, and I felt even more sorry for him. It was something that I would see with increased frequency, importers fearful of their suppliers, even though they were supposed to be the customer. The worst example of this strange phenomenon was made public with the Mattel case. Chinese manufacturers had caused the company great reputational damage by delivering toys that were contaminated with lead paint. A major recall was initiated in the United States, and by the time the dust settled, Mattel executives were in Beijing issuing an apology to the Chinese government for the damage they had caused the industry. It showed the true extent of Chinese savvy that manufacturers could behave in such a reckless fashion by using toxic substances and then get those who had been victimized to issue the apology instead. A German client of mine, a fellow named Norbert, asked me to look into heavy machinery for him. He wanted to find a supplier of forklifts and backhoes, one that would offer him exclusive representation for Germany and Austria. One manufacturer of 2-ton forklifts asked, "What market?" When I told him, he cut me short and said that they already had an exclusive arrangement with an agent in those territories. I was not yet 50 feet away from his booth, having moved on, when he caught up to me and in a low voice suggested that I ring him up after the show had concluded. "Maybe something can be arranged," he said. And I imagined that the importer who held the exclusive was either wandering around the show and the factory rep did not want to suffer the embarrassment of getting caught, or else he did not want one of his colleagues to know what he was planning. For a different product, I helped my German clients secure an exclusive for Germany and Austria. Business had been running smoothly for more than 2 years when I received a letter from the factory. They did not realize who they were sending the note to, apparently, and they announced that they would be exhibiting at a trade show in Hanover the following year. When I confronted the company representative, he played innocent. "My client's company still held exclusive rights to Germany and Austria," they insisted, but still, my client protested. "If we held the exclusive, should we not at least have been told about the plan to exhibit in Germany?" The company's president explained that their attending the trade fair did not in and of itself make them guilty of any wrongdoing. They were simply planning to exhibit at the show. Yes, they would be in our territory, and yes, there would be German buyers at the show, but the supplier had not done anything improper, at least not yet. Importers were starting to have a tough time in China, and some threatened to take their business elsewhere. Vietnam was becoming a new possible destination for manufacturing, and India seemed to be an interesting prospect. When one supplier at the Canton Fair quoted prices that were especially inflated, I protested, and in a fluster suggested that foreign buyers would one day get wise and flee. "One day soon we will all go to India," I said. At this mention, the industrialist brightened and he reached for his order book. Flipping through oversized pink carbon sheets, he pointed to one. "This is my customer. He is from India," he said. He flipped through more pages and pointed to another. "This one also, from India." He was proud of his Indian customers and of the fact that he had countered my suggestion so perfectly. That traders from India were beating a path to China showed the strength of the Chinese economy, he suggested. Prices in China were still low. The growing number of importers from around the world emboldened these suppliers. How could anyone ever convince them that there was something wrong with the way they operated their businesses when order sizes were on the rise and the competition itself was clamoring to come to China? Factories were doing all they could to draw in foreign importers. Once importers were actually in China, it was difficult to switch markets. And anyway, where were they going to go? Talk about India was just as empty as talk about a shift of production to places around Southeast Asia. Labor costs, and even currency exchange rates aside, Chinese manufacturers had figured out the system, and the convenience in manufacturing that China afforded was so significant that it forced importers to deal with a great number of drawbacks. Foreign visitors had no trouble gaining entry to the fair, but for locals it could be tricky. Unless you were an exhibitor, you either had to have an invitation letter from a supplier, or you had to be brought in as a translator under the accompaniment of a foreign buyer. Tina was curious about the fair, and the fact that she was not allowed free permission to attend was all of the motivation I needed to work on getting her inside. We made a plan to meet the next day and enter the fair together. The early morning sounds of the city got me out of bed without fail. The first noises to make their way to my apartment came from nearby construction projects, long before almost anyone in our complex was even considering getting out of bed. While I was still asleep, the rhythmic pounding from one project began. Donk, 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 donk. Some distance away, the whirring sounds from a second construction site got started. It was a saw blade cutting into metal, a sound that told me it was still early. This was, in effect, my early morning snooze button. Ween! Ween! The road in front of my building had been changed into a one-way street, and this created continual confusion for motorists who insisted on driving down the street in the wrong direction. Taxi drivers were especially ambitious in getting amateur motorists through the bottleneck. Their bleeding horns encouraged others. Bap, bap, bap. When the horn honking climaxed at a certain pitch, it was a clear sign that it was time to get moving. And by the time the sounds from the school nearby could be heard, it already felt as though the entire city were up and on the move, though it was barely 7:30. The sounds of the students' carefully timed calisthenics echoed through the canyon of high-rise buildings in the neighborhood, their reverberated shouts high-pitched and aggressive. The students sounded as though they were in a military exercise, and still in the hazy fog of sleep, I imagined them lunging in formation with make-believe bayonets in hand. Hia! 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 These were the stirrings of an economy on fast-forward, the echoes of rapid progress. I never needed any kind of clock radio at my bedside. The anxious early morning sound served as my daily alarm. At the Canton Fair, hundreds of Chinese stood waiting behind a crowd-control barricade. College students who were studying at the foreign trade school in the city held signs in various languages that said, "Interpreter," looking rather desperate, almost like political refugees or orphans hoping for a home. To get Tina past the hordes and into the fair, I had to present identification, and we had to say that she was to be my translator. Tina presented her own ID, and she had her picture taken. The picture was sealed into a plastic badge, which she was to hang around her neck. We paid the translator's fee of roughly $30 and moved into the exhibition hall. My hope was that Tina might learn something from the show, and the only errand I had for her was to pick up a number of catalogs for a client interested in ceramic floor tiles. It would not take long, and, if anything, the minor mission would lend a sense of purpose before giving her the day to explore the fair more freely. In a nearby hall, I found my way to the pottery section, and down one of the main aisles, I spotted a familiar company name. It was the factory owned by Kevin, the young industrialist who tried to convince me that he was from Los Angeles. His booth was a tall space. I stepped inside and caught him just as he was saying goodbye to a pair of trade show attendees who appeared Middle Eastern. "Was that Arabic you were speaking to them?" I asked. "I have many customers from Middle East," he said. He insisted that he knew only a few words. Still, I was impressed to hear anyone at the show communicating in anything other than English or Chinese through me. Chinese were actually going out of their way to learn foreign languages, which was not exactly what international relations theorists had predicted. Academics who touted hegemonic theory insisted that the world was speaking English, if only because the United States was the predominant political and economic power. China was rising to significance, these theorists insisted, and so the world would switch to Chinese. This was not what was happening in China, though, at least not in the world of export manufacturing. Importers who had every reason to learn the language were foregoing the opportunity. Instead, representatives at the manufacturers were learning the language of their customers. Part of it was motivated by simple economics. A full-time translator could be found in China for as little as $300 per month. Westerners had an opportunity cost that was much higher, and so it made sense for the lesser-developed economy to bear the burden of bridging the linguistic chasm. There was another reason why Chinese would learn the languages of the world before the world learned to speak its own, and this had to do with the skills required for learning Mandarin. Chinese contained thousands of characters, which were acquired only through rote memorization. While some argued that English was just as difficult for native Chinese speakers to learn as Chinese was for Americans, the Chinese at least had a great deal of experience in cramming information. The level of skill required to achieve fluency in Mandarin turned Chinese into language acquisition machines. Americans almost always felt more intimidated to learn Chinese than the other way around. I had just begun to wonder what Tina might be doing with herself when she called from her cell phone. She sounded upset, like she was in trouble. She was sobbing and could not speak clearly. I asked her to tell me where in the fair she was, and when I found her, she was in tears, with three security guards standing nearby. Tina explained that she had been stopped, and she told me that one of the security guards had grabbed her. "What did you do?" "Nothing," she said. I asked her whether she had shown them her badge, the one that gave her permission to be in the fair. She said that she had. I asked one of the guards to explain himself. He said only that he had the right to stop and hold anyone he chose, and just because Tina had permission to be at the show did not give her any special rights. The guards were unapologetic, and my arrival, by itself, signaled the end of the incident. China was not a racist country, but there existed a gap between two classes, the haves and the have-nots. It was not so much a caste system as it was a sociological divide, one based loosely on income and education. Tina was on the wrong side of the equation, but then so were the guards from the look of them. Why they stopped Tina was anyone's guess, but it was possibly because they saw in Tina something of themselves. Security guards earned some of the lowest salaries in China, and having come from modest backgrounds, they probably saw that Tina was not very well connected, that she was one of the few at the trade show who, like themselves, were left to strive for more. Tina had not yet told me the rest of her story. Earlier in the day, she visited the tile suppliers, but few were willing to give her their catalog. It was the same sort of snubbing. She had shown the exhibitors her business card and badge, but they were unmotivated. Tina would not say why they wouldn't give her the promotional literature, but this was also not hard to figure out. They didn't think that she was worth the effort. They figured that she was of no account and that the marketing materials would be wasted on her. Tina was made frail from so much rejection, and it was this that the security guards had also sensed before setting upon her like a pack of wild dogs. Hearing her tell me this story and seeing her upset, I became angry. I worked with all sorts of manufacturers, and they never treated me in such a manner. They spent small fortunes to exhibit at the trade show, and when I refused their catalogs, they pushed them onto me, even shoving them into my bag. They normally jumped at even the slightest hint of a business opportunity. I knew these factory reps well. Just like those security guards, their problem was that they saw themselves in Tina. They knew that what separated them was nothing more than a bit of luck, or maybe even some small personal connection. They looked at her and thought, "There but for the grace of Guan Xi go I." It was still early in the day, but Tina said that she wanted to go home. The show had been a disaster, and I felt bad. The whole idea of getting her to the fair was to expand her horizons. She had been curious, and had been rewarded only with a reminder that there were limitations to her ambitions. It was unfair. "I have an idea," I said. Tina was still in tears, and she looked down at the red carpet. "I think you should go back to the tile exhibitors and give them a different story. This time, tell them that you are working with a foreigner, one that is really stupid." It wasn't far from the truth. It was how I felt anyway for putting Tina in a situation that caused her embarrassment. If she simply gave up, though, that was even worse. Tina wiped her eyes with the back of her bare forearm and looked at me to see if I was serious. "Tell them what?" she asked. "Tell them you are working for a really stupid foreigner," I said. "An American, someone who can be easily cheated." She knew what I was driving at, but it wasn't her style. It was not a very Confucian notion either. I was suggesting that she put aside any respect that she might have for me, all for the sake of a ruse. This could be done in the spirit of not giving up, I suggested, and I told Tina that she might consider it an experiment. Her boyfriend was a marine scientist who ran experiments at sea, and so she somewhat warmed to the idea of testing a hypothesis. Maybe another approach would generate a different result. After a moment to collect herself, she agreed that she would go back and give it another try. We met later in the afternoon. This time she was happier. When something amused Tina, her cheekbones moved high, and when she was truly amused, it looked as though she were suppressing a case of the giggles. "It wasn't a problem?" I asked. "No," she said, bursting into laughter. "I told them that I worked for a stupid foreigner." Tina showed me all of the catalogs the factory reps had given her. She had two bags filled with them. Tina opened one of the bags and showed me some of the marketing materials. The company representatives that she spoke with gave them to her without hesitation after explaining her situation a bit more clearly. The idea of getting hooked up with a naive foreign buyer proved a fantastic temptation for these company representatives, and it trumped whatever other prejudices they held against Tina. The line worked so well, in fact, that her phone rang for weeks after the show with follow-ups from the tile factories.